talk about the Land Acquisition, Rehabilitation and Resettlement Bill that was recently passed by both Houses of Parliament. Once this bill receives presidential assent, which will probably happen fairly soon, it will become law and replace the 119-year-old Land Acquisition Act of 1894. And when that happens, it would mark the end of a six-year process of attempts first to amend and later to replace this 1894 Act that began sometime in 2007. Given the controversies and struggles surrounding the drafting of this bill, it is no surprise that the Land Acquisition Bill is a long and complicated piece of legislation with 115 sections and 4 schedules. In my talk today, I will analyze the most salient provisions of the bill with a view to determining the extent to which they redress the injustices experienced with the implementation of the 1894 Act. But before I do that, I want to say a few words about the 1894 Land Acquisition Act and about land acquisition in India more generally to put the changes instituted by the bill into context. So the first question that comes to mind when we talk about the Land Acquisition Bill is, why do we have a law of land acquisition in the first place? The power of the state to acquire land and other forms of property derives from what is often described in political and legal parlance as the eminent domain power of the state. This power, which is inherent in the exercise of a state's sovereignty, allows the state to forcibly acquire property belonging to private individuals upon the satisfaction of 3 conditions. The first condition is that such property may only be acquired under a validly enacted law. Secondly, such an acquisition must be for a public purpose. And third, it must only be done upon payment of just compensation. The first requirement is there in order to safeguard against arbitrary executive action, whereas the twin requirements of public purpose and just compensation are based on the rationale that no individual should have to disproportionately bear the burden of supporting the public good. So that's why we have a land acquisition law that empowers the government to acquire land belonging to individuals for a public purpose and upon payment of just compensation. The second point I want to note is that the 1894 Act itself was the product of a historical process of amendment, repeal, and replacement of colonial legislation regarding land acquisition dating as far back as the Bengal Regulation the 1st of 1824. Therefore, it is important to note that land acquisition has been a fairly controversial issue throughout the colonial and post-independence period, and that attempts to amend and replace laws pertaining to land acquisition are not new. The third point I want to note is that the Land Acquisition Act of 1894 was the most important, but only one of many laws of acquisition that were enacted by the British pre-independence. Other such laws included the Land Acquisition Mines Act of 1885 and the Indian Tramways Act of 1886, both of which are still in force. When the Constitution was adopted in 1950, like other colonial laws such as the Indian Penal Code and the Transfer of Property Act, the 1894 Land Acquisition Act was also saved by the Constitution to the extent that it did not conflict with the fundamental rights. According to the 7th schedule of the Constitution, land was included as a subject in the state list, but the acquisition and requisitioning of property was included as a subject in the concurrent list, thereby enabling both Parliament and state legislatures to enact laws for acquisition of land. As the Indian state post-independence pursued a program of economic development and social redistribution, more than 100 land acquisition laws were enacted by the central and state legislatures to achieve these goals. A majority of these laws were enacted in the first two decades post-independence and dealt with issues like zamindari abolition, town planning, slum clearance and development, and resettlement of refugees. Over the last 65 years, acquisition of land under the 1894 Act and other acquisition laws for the purposes of building dams, infrastructure and industrial projects resulted in the massive displacement and dispossession of poor peasants in traditional communities such as forest dwellers, cattle grazers, fishermen and tribal groups. But especially following the 1991 economic reforms, there was a surge in land acquisition by central and state governments keen on attracting foreign capital for dams, infrastructure and industry. With the enactment of the Special Economic Zones Act in 2005, the acquisition of land by the government to hand over to private industry, which had happened in an ad hoc manner in previous decades, became official government policy. Consequently, the severity of the land conflicts during this period led to massive public outrage and to moves first for comprehensive amendment of the 1894 Act in 2007, followed by attempts in 2011 to repeal and replace this act by the Land Acquisition Bill of 2011, which now in 2013 has been passed by both Houses of Parliament. So against this historical background, what were the problems with the 1894 Act that led to such huge public discontent and created the momentum for the repeal and replacement of the Act by the Land Acquisition Bill? The working of the 1894 Act had revealed five major problems. First, the Act only recognized the rights and interests of land title holders. In doing so, it failed to take into account the interests of those who, while not holding title to the land, were nevertheless dependent on it for their livelihood. These included sharecroppers, tenants, peasant cultivators, cattle grazers and forest dwellers. Second, the 1894 Act contained an inclusive and consequently an ever-expanding definition of public purpose for which the government could forcibly acquire land. Moreover, courts consistently deferred to legislative determinations of what constituted a public purpose. In successive cases, the Supreme Court held that the expression public purpose was elastic and could only be developed through a process of judicial inclusion and exclusion in keeping with the changes in time, the state of society and its needs. Courts also held that acquisitions benefiting particular individuals or entities could satisfy the requirement of public purpose so long as they were in furtherance of a scheme of public benefit or utility. Public benefit too was interpreted quite literally. As a result of such pronouncements, over time, the list of public purposes was continually expanded to include acquisitions for special economic zones, cooperative societies, private recreational projects, and private residential development, all of which were upheld by the courts. Till date, the Supreme Court has never found a law unconstitutional for violating the requirement of public purpose. The third problem with the 1894 Act derived from the legal requirement that persons deprived of their land and livelihood must be paid a fair equivalent of the value of land as compensation. Unlike their approach on public purpose, the Supreme Court took the compensation requirement seriously, insisting in its early decisions that the compensation payable in case of compulsory acquisitions be the market equivalent of the value of the land. However, through a series of constitutional amendments, Parliament substantially ousted judicial review of the quantum of compensation payable in individual cases. This resulted in a practice of legitimately paying less than market value compensation in many cases of acquisition. The fourth problem with the 1894 Act related to the procedure involved in land acquisition. This was criticized for delay in the completion of the acquisition, as well as delays in the determination and payment of compensation. The procedures were also criticized for lack of people's participation in the government's decision to take over their land. The fifth problem related to the misuse of the urgency clause to acquire land in non-urgent situations. Under the 1894 Act, the government could, in situations of urgency, which term was not defined in the Act, forcibly acquire land, bypassing most of the procedures for land acquisition prescribed in the Act. Over the last 65 years, successive national and state governments notoriously misused the urgency clause under the 1894 Act for ordinary acquisitions, simply in order to bypass the safeguards prescribed under the Act. Moreover, judicial scrutiny of such acquisitions was extremely deferential, with courts upholding their validity even when the government failed to use the land that was urgently acquired years later. So against this backdrop of the major problems experienced with the implementation of the 1894 Act, let us assess the provisions of the Land Acquisition Bill. Now, in my view, the bill remedies, with varying success, four out of the five main problems experienced with the functioning of the 1894 Act. Let's start with the two problems it fixes best, and then I will talk about the two problems I think it doesn't redress as well, and I will end with the problems and challenges the bill still leaves us with. First, by defining persons interested as those having an interest in the land, including tenancy and easement rights, as opposed to actual title, and by defining affected family as those dependent on the land for their primary source of livelihood, the bill broadens the group of people to be compensated in case of acquisition of land. Now, this had been a long-standing demand noted by the Law Commission in its 10th report as early as 1958. So I think it is a very good thing that more than 50 years later, this problem has been redressed to a significant extent in the Land Acquisition Bill. Second, the Land Acquisition Bill limits the invocation of the urgency clause in Section 41 to situations involving India's defense, national security, or for emergencies due to natural calamities, as well as any other emergency, but only with the approval of Parliament. If there is effective parliamentary supervision, then this new provision in the bill should greatly curb misuse of the urgency clause. The third problem the bill remedies to some extent is that of the ever-expanding definition of public purpose. The bill seeks to restrict the definition of public purpose by providing a much more detailed listing of public purposes. First, public purpose includes all activities related to defense and national security concerning the armed forces and other cases of public safety. Second, all infrastructure activities notified by the government, with the exception of private hospitals, private educational institutions, and private hotels, constitute a legitimate public purpose for which government may forcibly acquire land. Land may also be acquired for industrial corridors, mining, urban and rural development, sports, healthcare, transport, and space programs. The government may acquire land for these purposes for public-private partnerships as well as for private companies, although certain conditions apply when such acquisitions are for those purposes. While the government retains the power to add to the definition of infrastructure by notification, the good news is that this is a more restricted residuary power than that under the 1894 Act, which enabled the government to acquire land for any purpose the government deemed a public purpose. But since a substantial number of acquisitions are done for infrastructure purposes, and the bill provides an inclusive, not exhaustive definition of the same, careful judicial and public scrutiny of this provision is necessary to prevent its misuse. This is more so since, as I mentioned earlier, judicial scrutiny of public purpose under the 1894 Act was extremely lenient. So it will be particularly important to look at what activities the government notifies as constituting infrastructure. In other words, we must ensure that infrastructure does not become, to the new bill, what public purpose was to the 1894 Act. The fourth problem that the bill tries to remedy and succeeds to some extent in doing is that of the provision of inadequate compensation for forcible acquisition of land. The bill provides that the compensation payable upon acquisition would be up to 4 times the value of the average of registered sale deeds in rural areas and 2 times in urban areas. This amount includes the solatium amount that was paid on top of the market value under the 1894 Act. Moreover, the bill also provides for rehabilitation and resettlement awards. These awards include things like the provision of a constructed house in place of the house lost through acquisition of land. It also provides in certain cases, but not all, for the grant of land in place of the land acquired. The compensation provisions of the bill have been heavily criticized by everyone. Those speaking on behalf of peasants and traditional communities have argued that given the rampant undervaluation of land and improperly maintained land records, these communities will still lose out on receiving a just compensation. On the other hand, those speaking on behalf of industry have heavily criticized the compensation provisions, arguing that the bill will make acquisition extremely costly and prevent industrial growth. Now, of course, acquisition will be more costly under the bill, but how much more costly it will vary greatly from region to region. Similarly, the justness of compensation paid also vary from region to region. Here, it must be noted that the Land Acquisition Bill only sets the floor for the compensation payable in case of acquisitions. State governments are free to amend the law to provide more compensation, though in past experience, they have rarely done so. The fifth problem that the bill tries to remedy is the lack of people's participation in the government's decision to take over their land. The bill contains a procedure for social impact assessment of projects, which seeks to ensure greater public participation in acquisition proceedings. The bill also provides for appraisal of the social impact assessment report by an independent expert group composed of social science experts and representatives of gram panchayats. This body has the capacity to make recommendations, but such recommendations are not binding on the committee that undertakes the social impact assessment, which committee was composed solely of bureaucrats. Now, there were many demands by activists groups that this committee should also contain representatives from the gram panchayats or independent experts, but that recommendation was not accepted by the government. So it's great that we have this provision for social impact assessment, but if the environment impact assessments conducted today under the environmental laws are anything to go by, the provision regarding social impact assessment is open to considerable misuse and arbitrariness, and unless closely monitored, will add to delays in acquisition, thereby negatively affecting both the landowners as well as the projects for which the land may be acquired. Moreover, I do believe there is a genuine concern which has been voiced repeatedly by industry as well as by peasants and traditional communities about the layers of bureaucracy added by the bill in acquisition and rehabilitation and resettlement procedures. The effectiveness of these procedures, which have been included to ensure greater fairness and justice in land acquisition proceedings, will depend upon the effectiveness and efficiency of the bureaucracy that will administer them. But as we know, inefficiency and corruption are rampant in our bureaucracy. So unfortunately, there is a possibility that these procedures, though included for the purpose of doing justice, might end up doing some injustice. Moreover, it must be noted here that acquisitions under the urgency clause are exempt from social impact assessments. So that once again points to the need for careful public and judicial scrutiny of the urgency clause to prevent misuse of that provision. Finally, one big problem that remains with the bill is that the bill exempts 13 laws, including the Electricity and Railways Acts, the Coal Bearing Areas Act, and the Land Acquisition for Mines Act from its acquisition and rehabilitation provisions. Interestingly, earlier this exemption schedule contained 16 laws, including the Special Economic Zones Act of 2005, but that has now been taken out. So despite the fact that the bill contains this schedule for exempting these 13 laws, it also mandates the center within 1 year of the commencement of the act to apply the bill's provisions to acquisitions made under these exempted laws. Given this mandate, it is not clear why the exemption was created in the first place. Since significant land acquisition occurs under the exempted laws, the impact of the land acquisition bill in redressing the problems under the 1894 Act will be limited unless its provisions are extended to all laws. Moreover, the Centre has been given the power to add laws to this schedule merely by executive notification. Even though this notification has therefore thereafter to be scrutinised by Parliament, the efficacy of such supervision will depend upon the composition of Parliament at various points in time. Consequently, this provision greatly limits the bill's efficacy in remedying the injustices caused by land acquisition in the past, and it also creates scope for litigation given its confusing drafting, which is obviously very problematic. So I will end by saying that land acquisition is inevitably a controversial issue in nations with land scarcity, which are trying to achieve rapid economic development through greater industrialization. Clearly, India is no exception. The land acquisition bill that was passed by Parliament is a compromise between various conflicting interests. So obviously, it hasn't pleased anyone completely. But we have to remember that compromise is intrinsic to the nature of a constitutional democracy. The land acquisition bill is a first step in the right direction for ushering in a culture of justification, wherein the government is required to explain and engage with the people it dispossesses of their land and livelihood of the legitimacy and necessity of such dispossession. The bill certainly shifts the balance of power between the various competing constituencies to some extent, but it doesn't end the struggle between conflicting interests, which will continue even after the bill becomes law. Ultimately, as we know, the text of the law, however empowering it be, can only go so far in ensuring fairness in land acquisition proceedings. The real test is its effective implementation, but for that, we need serious institutional reform at all levels of government. Thank you.